everybody. Welcome once again. Thank you for joining us on our ICC podcast. Today, I'll be talking to Dr. Zeina Alouchi. Zeina, is this how I pronounce it?
It's Alouch.
Alouch.
In Arabic, we say Alouch, so that's fine. And you can skip the doctor, please.
Okay. Just for the sake of the podcast, Dr. Zeina Alouch. She's an international expert on child protection, and she's achieved a PhD in interdisciplinary PhD from Concordia University. I'm just going to open the floor to you, Zeina. So maybe tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, so that our audience could know a bit more about you and maybe your positionality.
Yeah, thank you for this opportunity, Daniel. I'm very honored to be sharing my own story in connection with my research topic, which is forced separation from community and family and identity as well. So, first I would like to acknowledge that I am now located, even if we are on that cloud, virtual cloud, but I am now located on unceded lands, namely Jojoke, Montreal, that is known as a place to welcome all people from various nationalities, identities, and So I, as a way to honor the space and honor the hospitality of Indigenous people, I would like to always reflect on my commitment to always tell the other side of the story, the unheard and the oppressed and repressed from, like, that's the way I would like to position myself now where I am at. I am a settler. I am an immigrant. I also have the privilege of carrying the Canadian passport, which is a big privilege, and I would like to honor that privilege as well. I come from Lebanon, and it's hard for me to say I'm Lebanese because this identity is loaded with the colonial history, being colonized myself, like the country, for long years. I'm always trying to unpack the colonial in me that also dictates sometimes the way I perceive people and issues around me. When I immigrated to Canada, I had the privilege of joining Concordia to reconnect with my studies after 25 years of finishing my master's. And it was a way to be acknowledged in a country of immigration. So we are reborn here as if our history is erased. So I felt that the best thing is that I go back to studying just to exist in this new country and new city. And this is how I got to work on my, we call it interdisciplinary individualized PhD, because it combines it should combine three disciplines. So my disciplines are social studies. I don't know if you're hearing the airplane, but it's just like passing over.
It's okay, no problem.
Okay, so my PhD is in social sciences, arts, and oral history.
Right.
And I worked on the narratives of individuals who have been forced into separation, mainly transracial or intercountry adoption. But the whole research was grounded in Indigenous methodologies as a way to, as an attempt to ensure an ethical approach to a topic that is really is politically sensitive, and there is a lot of myth evolving around the way the normative way of perceiving adoption as a good practice. Right. So that's me. I am also a mother. I have two young adults now. No. Zad, he's 23, and Yasmin is 20, and they are both studying. That actually, my son finished his studies at Concordia and finished his master's in research creation, and Yasmin is studying psychology and dance at Concordia as well.
Wow, Zeina, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's so rich, and thank you for your, you know, positioning yourself. That was really complete. And for my part, as you know, I'm currently on the island of Rogotan, which is an island off the coast of Honduras. This is a traditional territory of the Garifuna and the Garifuna and the Afro-descendant communities who were brought here against their own will on slave ships, and they were placed on this island. But ever since then, they've become considered indigenous people of these lands. So in that respect, thank you for reminding me also to position myself. But without further ado, you mentioned, Zeina, you are, in particular, you have a specialization in oral history. And talk to me about that, because I know your project that I reviewed, the Ineradicable Voices, Narrative Towards Rerouting, it uses oral history. And in particular, oral history is something important in indigenous methodology. Maybe tell us a little bit about, to our audience who might not be familiar with, what indigenous methodologies are and the significance of oral history and the role it plays in giving voice to the unheard and giving voice to the voiceless, let's say.
Yeah, it's like oral history, the main purpose is to place voices who are not given spaces. Whose spaces were stolen in a way to occupy the public discourse, just like taking back the space and taking back the discourse and revealing the unheard discourse and the silenced discourse. So oral history comes as a way to honor those voices and bring them as is, without interference, without decontextualization, as is. They are on the forefront to inform the practice and to inform the political, social spaces. So that was the main reason why oral history was the main methodology and the main representation of the research. Also, I would like to highlight that in I would say I, because the research, the PhD research, as you said, it was based on indigenous methodologies. And in indigenous methodologies, there is a collective ownership over the research process, but also the research worldview, and then the research outcome. Right. So whenever I refer to that project, I would like to be referred at as a collective rather than an individual. Of course, I earned my PhD based on that, and I have to acknowledge that it was also a privilege, because most of the participants, they didn't earn the PhD with me. So right. Though it's their voices as well. So I have to be careful when I speak about that project. So this is the essence of the indigenous methodologies, is that it's grounded in the collective, and that the owners of the stories, they should have equal authority over the research process. And this is why when I started even developing the project proposal of my research, it was based on consultation with people who have experienced adoption. And then there was an advisory committee overseeing the whole process since inception of the project. And the advisory committee was formed from people who experienced adoption, and they were governing the whole process, from selecting the worldview about adoption till selecting participants, towards also the way we created the performance. And right. even when I wrote my thesis, they read it. All the participants and the advisory committee read my draft before submitting it to the academia.
Wow, that's amazing. I can't. You must have taken extra care, because submitting a PhD thesis and just having a committee of five read over is complicated enough as it is, and having to have everybody going over it, that's going the extra mile. That's really well done. Yeah, and as you mentioned, collectivity is a really important key concept here, and that we're all, you said you honor the stories that the participants kind of provided to you as if they are just as much the owners of this narrative creation.
Of course, and that, like, even the performative aspect of it, we were 23 collaborators working to create that 50 minutes with the stories, even the selection of which parts of the narratives should be there and the sequence of the collective narratives. It was all based on collective endeavor.
That's right. That's super interesting. Zena, going back to this, this importance of creating space for new voices to come through. Some people may say, well, what's wrong with the stories that we have? Like, what's wrong with the discourse, with the dominant discourse?
You said it. Like, I don't have to. You said, what's wrong with the dominant discourse? It's because it's dominant.
It's a dominant discourse. And
so the dominant is always being dominant. It means there is a power. And there are voices that are not enough represented, and these most of the time are the silenced voices by the dominant discourse, and going against the dominant discourse is not a safe process. And right. this is why indigenous methodologies inform us how to, you said create, I would rather say let go the space, because sometimes we researchers also, we use the authority and the power and the privilege we have. So I don't give myself the credit, I didn't create the space. I took the space that I needed the way I feel comfortable doing it. And then to be able to do that safely, I told my stories in a performative way. Like I shared my own story a couple of times before coming to the research space, because I wanted to undergo the same risks of being exposed in public in a performative way. And it's only by living it yourself that you tend really to understand what does it mean to share a silenced story that is contradicting or confronting the dominant discourse. So telling the narrative of adoptees is not a safe process for the adoptees, because there is a lot of, it defies the fairy tale of adoption.
Right. No, absolutely. And how is this discourse intertwined in coloniality? Is the dominant discourse colonial?
Of course, all this, when you listen to people talking about adoption as a way to give out of yourself, to save a child who is poor, who was abandoned, and here come the heroes who will save that child by giving them new identity. And most of the time, those adoptees are coming from the South to be adopted in the North. So we don't see a child coming from the North adopted by an Ethiopian family. So unfortunately, this is the situation. So it's the white savior complex. So this fairy tale, in fact, is has nothing to do with reality. It's most of the time people who desire to have a child, and I would emphasize on the word desire, because having a child is not a right. Having a child is a desire, and when this desire is unfulfilled for many reasons, people tend to use their privilege and outsource. And if we look at the story from the views of the adoptees, adoption is not about constructing families. It's about demolishing the biological family of the child. And that is a perspective that is totally erased from the scene. So even adoptees, when they are adopted in a family, they change the birth date, they change the name, as mm-hmm. if the child was born again. And it's not true, because there is all the heritage inside the child. The when you ask an adoptee, what's your mother tongue? So what's the mother tongue of an adoptee? Like, really, in the question, there are many things that we tend not to think of, but that creates a dilemma. What's the real birth date? I would like to be less confusing, the horoscope of an adoptee that is based on their, and most of the time, 99% of the cases, their birth date is falsified.
Right.
And
right.
So these are simple things that we take for granted, but that might really disturb the life of any person living in that situation. And in my work on documenting adoption practices, it interfaces with child trafficking for adoption purposes. Wow. So in all the cases that I've worked on, most of the time the child was put in an orphanage, and then there they were processed to adoption through illegal processes. And this is the big dilemma. It entails invoices, it entails paying money. Because remember, those families who do not qualify for adoption in their countries, they travel overseas through adoption agencies, and they bypass the waiting line. And I can speak easily about Lebanon. We don't have any legal process that governs international adoption. So it's left up to who pays more, and then you can create a falsified passport, falsified identity, falsified name, even falsified birth certificate. The same trend was documented across the world, and it's ingrained in the 60s scoop in Canada. When in the 1960s, 97% of Indigenous children were abducted into forced adoption and within non-Indigenous families. And the research, incredible research done by amazing Indigenous researchers, they confirmed that almost 90% of those adoptions failed.
Wow.
And the cases of maltreatment, child abuse, you name it.
Yeah.
And this is what they call intergenerational trauma. I prefer to call it the intergenerational forced separation, because it's not that the trauma is recreating itself. It's mainly, until now, 40% of children in the child welfare system in Canada, they come from Indigenous descent.
Right. Right. So that's, I guess, this is really important. And I guess the crux of the matter In a way, you could, one could say the dominant narrative of, I mean, this, the dominant narrative that's intertwined with this white savior complex, that's intertwined with the adoption process, has its basis maybe in the reservations, in the forced separation of indigenous children from their community.
It's a continuation of the residential schools.
Right.
So remember in the 1800 when the colonial arrived into indigenous spaces and they started to separate children by putting them into residential schools. And I would like here to mention a quote by Duncan. I would like to highlight his name as such so I don't forget. It's the Duncan Campbell Scott. In 1920, he was the superintendent of Indigenous Affairs, of Indian Affairs at that time. And he said, I want to get rid of the Indian problem. And this is why the residential schools will keep on abducting all those Indigenous kids into their system. And we know what happened in the residential schools, and you know that until today, the graves are being discovered with all the kids being murdered there.
That's right.
So the residential schools were not about only assimilating the children, but also about getting rid of Indigenous children. So this is why it's called genocide. The absurdity of things is that when the same colonial arrived into our area in the Arab region, recreated the model of the residential schools. So we have all those big institutions in our area based on that colonial model. And they were meant mainly to the word I would like to abduct the children into their system and being assimilated in the Christian worldview and perspective. Yes. And then we in the Arab world, the Muslim communities were jealous of those big institutions, and they started to reproduce the same model addressing Muslim kids.
Wow.
Yeah, this is the history of the existence of those big institutions. Otherwise, we didn't have, like, even with if you go back to the same period of time with the Armenian genocide, the Turkish system created the same model of residential schools. And like in the literature review I've made while preparing for my research, the objective of those residential schools was to Turkify the Armenian children. Wow. So it was never about really helping poor kids who are orphans, whatever. It was a political act. It was a war act. And then adoption started as a practice in the 1960s from our part of the world, in parallel to what was happening in Canada and all over the world.
Wow.
Just like, and the church is part of that child trafficking affair. All the apologies that are coming through to try to rectify that history, it's not helpful because this system needs to be dismantled.
Wow. Well, this is really powerful, Zaina. In other words, you might say that the experience of the First Nation and Indigenous people genocide in the America was replicated across the world by...
Yeah, the child welfare system. I lost you a bit.
Sorry, Zaina.
It's okay.
Got frozen there. I was going to say, so in other words, what you're kind of pointing to is that the experience of the genocide of the First Nation and Indigenous people was kind of replicated through the colonial system on a global level.
Yeah, it's everywhere until today. And you've heard about what happened in Haiti with the big scandal of Arche de Noé, the French organization based, like faith-based organization that was part of a big child trafficking scandal. Yeah, because until now in those poor countries, there are people who are trying to separate children through trafficking, through profit-making transactions, with the idea that we're saving, but it's not true. It's a big cartel. It's right. A big cartel, and those this cartel works in parallel with drug traffickers, human traffickers, weapons traffickers. It's the same mechanism.
It's so unfortunate. I mean, like you said, there's this fairy tale about adoption. I mean, I imagine there must be adoption stories that are good, that is rooted in, you know, goodwill of people doing good. However,
thanks God that not all children. I'm not addressing individuals. I'm discussing the institutional approach. So if you want to do good, you don't have to deracinate a child. Help the child to stay with their mothers,
right,
with their communities. This is the best thing you can do if we are true about doing good.
And you know, this is really important, because in the narrative towards regrouping, the performances, you know, it really helped break through that fairy tale narrative of adoption. And really what came through are the participants' sense of pain and hardship that they experienced as a result of this. Would you call it isolation or de-rooting of their identity, their indigenous identity, their indigenous connections, cultures, and their original family? That pain seemed to come through with the participants.
Yeah, and then regardless of the place of origin and the place of adoption, and this is the, I think, the strength of that performance piece, because it conveys that regardless of from where to where, the pattern of the experience is similar. There are individual stories, of course, there are individual experiences, but the patterns are the same. That feeling of being, I find it the best word, deracinated, totally deracinated, it's common. But I would like to highlight that the biological mother is also absent, is totally silenced. And until now, we are finding it very hard to hear more from the biological mother, because she is often blamed of letting go their child. But like my work on documenting reunification processes, the story of the mother, the biological mother, is always a story of systemic violence and racism, of course. I don't want to forget this, because I always use this example. Angelina Jolie is an incarnated goodwill ambassador to UNHCR.
That's right.
He adopted 7 kids, and the 7 kids that she adopted, their adoption processes were also not ethical. First, let's discuss it. A mother can take care of 1 child. 2 is okay. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, why? Why? And then if you have money and you have ability to support, why don't you give back to those children in their communities rather than deracinating them? And so this is the myth. We incarnate goodwill ambassadors while we are just turning our eyes on the process towards this. So
yes,
She cannot adopt a child from Zimbabwe without paying money, without falsifying the documents, without having falsified identity. But once in the America, they are Americans. But adoptees in the US, they are under the immigration law.
Okay. What does that mean, Zeina?
It's different status, and if they ever try to reclaim their biological identity, they will lose any.
Wow.
So imagine in terms of language, you live in the US, you learn English, you don't know anything about your original biological language, and if you're deported, you're back into a country where you have no connection at all. No roots.
Right.
And I know many of the adoptees who claimed back their biological identities, and they were literally deported.
That's right. Unbelievable.
So it's
unbelievable.
It's political.
Right. It's, of course. Wow, I didn't know that. That's really fascinating. And you know, one thing we observe with like a lot of First Nation and Indigenous communities is that when you take away a person's cultural roots, identity, their family, you know, it, what you mentioned is the intergenerational trauma, but you call it something else, intergenerational separation.
I would say intergenerational forced separation.
And this creates a lot of psychological issues. You know, you see increasing rates of depression, alcohol or abuse, substance abuse. And you know, I'm gonna go on a limb here and say, even in our Muslim Iranian community, we see similar dynamics. We have this sense of exile and derootedness, creating these issues of you know, psychological, emotional issues.
And this is why I learned a lot of my experience as an immigrant in Canada while doing my research, because there is a lot of intersection in terms of being transported and forced to disconnect with your own language, culture, rhythm, music, you name it, smells, you name it. Right. So, and even like the myth of immigration as a fairy tale that we are squeezed in, because we never leave our countries out of privilege. It is a privilege to be able to immigrate, but we run away from a certain oppression and marginalization. So we need also to be aware of that and to reflect on that as immigrants as well. But talking back to on that performance, I had a couple of indigenous, amazing people who lived on the streets.
Wow.
Who lived for 10, 15 years on the streets, because on streets, they found people that look like them.
Wow.
I remember Jennifer saying that on streets, she reconnected with the sense of humor that she had. And this was also recognized by an adoptee from Lebanon to the Netherlands, who said also, when I tell a joke in the Netherlands, she never lived in Lebanon because she was adopted as a baby, but her sense of humor is more like the Lebanese sense of humor. So when she tells a joke in the Netherlands, nobody laughs, and they might think that she's being aggressive or something. But when she tells me the same joke, I would laugh. And and this is how you feel estranged from the people around when even your sense of humor is not recognized.
Wow.
So imagine now when I walk on the streets in Montreal, when I see a group of indigenous people sitting on the streets and just laughing among each other, I would say I understand that.
Wow.
And I am humbled by their ability. If we speak about resilience, this is the way they are surviving. by reconnecting with each other, by being able to laugh even at us among each other. So that feeling of, again, being derooted is very tough. And it creates a lot of problem. And I think by deconstructing that myth around adoption, we are also helping those adoptees to acknowledge and to be able to share their stories of pain, because they are silenced by gratitude.
Yeah.
We've done good to you. Why are you saying this about us? There is a kind of silence imposed on them because they need to be grateful. But what if they were meant to live in their own original context? And back to the indigenous ways of like prior to colonialism, there were issues also. Some of children needed alternative care or need to be separated. They had what they call custom adoption, whereby in a ceremony, a child who needs a mother and a father were publicly placed by the name of the community in the hands of a family to take care of the child. And then the child would be given a sacred name as a way to give additional protection for that child.
Wow.
And this was also part of our practices in the Arab world, the tribe. There are sayings that if you live within a tribe for 40 days, you're part of the tribe, you're adopted into the tribe, and that the tribe is the caretaker of the community itself, and they had their own judicial system, their child welfare system. It's only with colonialism that the big institutional mind came to deconstruct the community nest. So it was an act of war hidden under doing good.
That's really interesting. So there seems to be almost like indigenous way of adoption included community. The community was always front and center. And then it's somehow you're making a distinction here, I think, with coloniality, which takes the community away and takes adoption and decontextualizes it from the community where the child is being adopted. And then
absolutely,
in doing so, deroots the child from its origin connection, and this in itself creates problems of emotional.
It creates the problem for the child because the center of the community was taken away, so it's derooting of the child, but it dismantled also the community itself, because the community, the indigenous communities, are centered around children. So when you take away the children, the community will collapse.
That's right. Wow, that's powerful, Zaina. That's really powerful. And this is almost the imposition of self-ways, or the modern self-ways, the modernity of individualism.
And this is why I learned, I worked with UNICEF for long years. Okay, so I was also colonized by their approaches, and I had always that myth, adoption is the best practice, and the child is individual, we have to, like, it's the best interest of the child. There is no best interest of the child if not seen in a perspective of a family and community. The individualization of the child, we're not saying that not every single person is an individual, has an individual pathway, character, whatever, but that approach to rather dismelt, like deconstruct the community, is a colonial mind to not to have any kind of structure in place. So in a way, it's a political act.
Right, of course. And that's really important. I think what your project did, first of all, it shows this politicization of adoption and how it's part of this colonial mentality that persists today. I mean, a lot of people think coloniality is done and over with, but in fact, it's written into every aspect of our institutions and and, and social ideology.
And also, like, if you think about the school systems, I am very privileged to be able to speak English and French, and I learned this in my home country in Lebanon. But imagine how many are you losing Arabic because of the dominant schooling system coming from the colonial side.
I wouldn't know. Is that a lot?
It's, of course, like the generations that are being educated, assimilated in French and English systems.
Wow.
In our part of the world are losing.
Oh, wow.
So it's not only like, it's not only the child welfare system, but the schooling system. And we can think of it from a financial perspective, whatever. And what's happening now in the Arab world, the whole absurdity of what's happening is all a colonial manipulative.
You might say it's a reaction to the crisis of coloniality that's been created. Right. So I'm trying to be aware of time, but there's so much I want to talk to you, Zeina. But trying to close this, our conversation, coming to a close, how does this adopt this, this investigation you've done, this space creation process that you've embarked on, how has that affected your sense of indigeneity, how does that speak to this process of truth and reconciliation as a way of moving forward towards reconciling with, Canada? Of course, we live in Canada, being Canadian and also being, Lebanese, Muslim, and dealing with all these different identities, how does that inspire a sense of peace in you?
As I said, my journey towards this research project was telling me a lot about myself. And in my thesis, I reflected a lot about my learnings from the methodology, but also from the stories. I would like here to quote, to share with you a story. While we were preparing for the performance, so we used a technique that's called headphone verbatim. So people would be wearing headphone and listening to the narratives of the adoptees and saying it on the same time. The purpose of it is that first, we don't put the adoptees on the forefront of the performance space, so they don't also have to face any discussion or any labeling, so a way to protect them. And this was also their wish, and in a way to be able to just recreate the same tone, the same perspective, the same the story as given. And this by itself was a transformative process for the people who were telling their stories. So the performers were telling the story, because it was all about transformation, because not all the collaborators in the process were adopting the post-colonial critical theory of adoption. Some participants with us were with adoption practices, but they lived the transformation process while we were creating the performance piece. And there was a lot of discussions, heated discussion. So when I was trying to pair the performer with the adoptee, one of the performers had Lebanese accent. And the owner of the story was indigenous. Mm. So I was told that, okay, we will accept this, but we need to mention in the performance that the performers have different accent, and that most of the adoptees, they've lost their accent because they were assimilated and acculturated in the new language. And then suddenly I realized that my accent, who was for like the minute I arrived in Canada, was a source of embarrassment for me. People like pointing at me, ah, you have accent, we don't understand you. Suddenly, I realized that it's a privilege.
Wow, that's awesome.
Like, yeah, the mere fact that I can still preserve my accent is part of my identity that I didn't let go. Though my kids, as a second generation immigrants, they are losing that accent.
Right. Yeah, and it's fascinating because sometimes the immigration experience or the experience of exile, especially, actually, you know, part of it, I consider a lot of Iranian people deeply indigenous, just in their perspective, their worldview, narratives. When they come into, when they migrate into a colonial system, right, they start developing a lot of self-hatred or self, not hatred, but also disdain for their identity, for the indigenous, because I guess what the media creates this Islamophobic, Iranophobic image of, you know, a Muslim person, you know, as this is the image that they create. And then you all of a sudden, you start thinking, well, I'm not this, I don't want to be associated with this. And then you start disassociating yourself with what you're told your identity is. And this creates a lot of internal conflicts for us. And this switch from going from a place of shame to pride, I think is really important, isn't it? It's a really important healing process in order to, I don't know, achieve a sense of peace, no?
Yeah, and then like the sudden, the moment I was faced with that argument, I felt it directly. And then I said, okay, Zaina, be happy with your accent. And yeah, like who said the British English is better? Because sometimes we don't understand. Who said that accent is better? And this is me. This is what creates me and what makes me a different or unique individual. And that call for diversity, cultural diversity in Canada, is also should be seen critically, because we want to integrate, but we don't want to be erased. Mm-hmm. And the dance between those two places is not easy, because sometimes it's much easier also when they create like, and to be also critical, we know that there is a big Lebanese community here, there is a big Iranian community, but sometimes we are here because we are fleeing away from that community that was there, and because this is the dominant community. So we don't want to be part of it, because if I want to be part of it, I would have stayed in Lebanon. So the reason of my immigration sometimes is that there is something with that community that pushed me out. So to exist in here, they push us back into our communities or into a total assimilation. You can, as if you cannot exist as you are and be part of the scene. And absolutely. So it's hard, because again, it goes against the dominant
right.
discourse. And it demystifies, and demystification is not always easily received or well received. So you need to be, you need to exist, you need to work to earn money, to pay your invoices, but still you need to be you, not what they want you to be.
That's powerful. I think that's a great note to maybe leave it off for another episode. Zaina, it was a pleasure. I really enjoyed talking to you, and you know, a lot of your experiences speaks to my experience as well. And part of the reason I'm also interested in working with indigenous nations in the Americas, because I know the colonial experience here in the Americas is also the colonial experience that many people around the world are faced with today. But for that, I really thank you for your work, for your valuable work, for the work of your participants. And I really hope that we could have you on again and we could continue our conversation.
Thank you
Anything
so
else
much.
You'd like to, do you like to tell us before we go?
It was a privilege to discuss with you, and thank you for the questions and the understanding and the reflection, because also you were giving me back things to reflect on. So thank you for that exchange and for the good work Absolutely. You're doing as well.
Much appreciated. Thank you, Zeyna. Dr. Zeyna, we'll talk to you soon. Bye, everybody.